17, 2025, 12:30 p.m. The board's mission is to protect the health, welfare, and safety of the public who seek to use the services of nursing care institution administrators and assisted living facility managers. Pursuant to ARS 38-431.02, notice is hereby given to the members of the State of Arizona Board of Examiners of Nursing Care Institution Administrators and Nurse Assisted Living Facility Managers, the board, this legislative subcommittee, and to the general public that the legislative subcommittee will hold a virtual meeting, which is open to the public, on Friday, January 17th, 2025 at 12:30 p.m. via Google Meets, which is meets.google.com/DOB-NJDI-TEA, or participants of attendees may join by phone, which is 1-575-518-3262, and the PIN is 909-906-706#. Person with disabilities may request a reasonable accommodation, such as a sign language interpreter, by contacting Jack Confer at 602-542-8156 or through the Arizona Relay Service at 711. Please make sure your request is early as possible to allow time to arrange the accommodation. The purpose of the subcommittee is to discuss House Bill 2183. The subcommittee may establish consensus on statutory changes suggested in the bill, determine alternative language for the bill, or identify opposition to the bill or its intent. The subcommittee agenda for January 17, 2025 is as follows. We are called to order and we will do roll call, please. Is Brian doing roll call, or is Jack doing roll call? Or am I doing roll call?
We can just do a voice roll call. Stacy is staffing the meeting. But if we could just go around the room, do a voice roll call, that would be great.
Perfect. I'll start. My name is Susan Archer. I'm the president of the NCIA board.
Hey, I'm Ken Kidder. I'm a member of the NCIA board and administrator.
Sorry, Ken. Becky Hill, member of the NCIA board, family rep.
Alan Emig, executive consultant to the board.
Go ahead. I'm just going to go down the list. Go ahead, Amy.
My name is Amy Malkin. I'm the executive director of Arroyo Gardens Independent and Assisted Living in Green Valley.
Thank you. Kelsey?
Kelsey Lane, director of education for Arizona Leaning Age.
Thank you. Jeff?
Jeffries Barrett, Director of Leadership and Workforce Development for the Arizona Healthcare Association.
Thank you. Karen? Okay. Karen, I think you're muted. We're going to, Al, if you can introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, Alan Emig, Nursing Care Board of Examiners, Executive Consultant.
Thank you. Thank you. And we have, is David here?
Yep. Hi, Jack. Dave Vopel, CEO for Arizona Healthcare Association.
Thank you. And Stacy?
Stacy Rodriguez, and then I'm a project specialist here with the NCIA board.
Thank you. And Karen, would you like to introduce yourself? We didn't hear you if you did. Oh, you're still muted. Karen, there's a telephone call in on the invite. You may want to try that as well. And I also have somebody calling in on a 602 number. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Don Isaacson, on behalf of Arizona Leading Age.
Thank you, Don. Welcome. Did I miss anybody?
That's everybody okay. I see.
Okay. The floor is yours, Susan.
All right. Next up is declaration of conflicts of interest. pursuant to ARS 38-503. Does anybody have a conflict of interest to announce? Okay, moving on. Number four, nomination and vote for a subcommittee chair. I would like to nominate Ken as the chair. Ken Kidder. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. I guess are we doing a roll call vote here? Or should we just do aye? Let's just quote it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, you want a voice, roster vote? No? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, Ken, it's all yours.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining the subcommittee meeting today, and welcome our stakeholders that are joining us. We're here to discuss House Bill 2183, and the reference title is Nursing Care Assisted Living Board. I don't know if everybody has a copy of that at this point. If you don't, let us know so that we can get you a copy, or it's available on the AZ leg under the HB 2183. So there's several things in here. Jack, who is the person that actually in legislative committee that actually did or promulgated the document?
It's Representative Bliss, Chair Kidder, members of the subcommittee.
On the council, drafter, Michelle.
Legislative Council.
Yeah, Michelle Hannigsberg actually put it together. So some of the things, there's small amendments on there, and I think that that's where she was just cleaning up some of our language to make it more logical and readable. There are several things that we are trying to achieve for this year. From the administrator standpoint, in 2022 in our licensing cycle, we lost 60 administrators, which at that time represented almost 20% of all licensed administrators in the state. I think that number has come back up. I do not have current statistics yet to confirm that, but I will get that information if that is needed. To see where we are today. The concern is that so many of our administrators are baby boomers, and they're getting older and they're starting to drop out. And our concern is about being able to have enough qualified people to be able to continue on in this industry successfully, from today and on into the future. So the way our current statutes and rules are set up, there are several roadblocks that make it more difficult for somebody to come in either by reciprocity or by initial licensure. And that language is in the bill. And it also gives provision for individuals that may not meet all of our current requirements that would be otherwise qualified to be a successful administrator, that at this time are not eligible to be able to become one. And my example is that my director of nursing and I have worked together for 16 years, and she has an AA nursing degree, and she has over 25 years of experience in healthcare. And if something happened to me today, she wouldn't qualify to be able to become an administrator right away. However, she would be able to step right into my shoes and take over and run this building successfully. Her situation now is that she's a associate's degree nurse with, 5 of the last 7 years of requisite experience. But if she was to apply to become an administrator, she would now have to go through an administrator and training program. And I think due to her, long experience, in a nursing care institution, I think that at this point, an AIT would be redundant and would not make her any more qualified than if we were able to remove that requirement for a person like her. So that's part of where the language is that it opens it up to people that have the requisite experience in a nursing care institution that really should be able to apply, sit for the test, and not have to go through the administrator training program. So that's the point on that. Also, looking at a change for the temporary license, it would get rid of the automatically revoke the temporary license if they fail the test. And I think for others is that, well, they're in the substantive time period. If they do request a temporary license, they can take the test as many times as they need to during the 150 days. The new legislation does give a proviso for an extension of the temporary license for another 60 days if necessary, if requested. So the proposal would be with those that have an associate's degree in a health-related field, have worked in an inpatient setting in a healthcare facility, have the requisite number of years of experience, this bill would eliminate the administrator and training program. I think it is essential to have an administrator training program for initial licensure, because when I came into this business, I had not come from healthcare, and I benefited immensely from having the AIT. So that still needs to be there for initial licensure. We're also looking at the reciprocity agreement, getting rid of some small roadblocks that would impinge on somebody's ability to come in from another state. For instance, if somebody has an AA degree but is already licensed for a requisite period of time, I think, is it 2 years, Jack? They've been a successful administrator in another state. I don't think that we should have to require them to get a bachelor's degree in order to qualify for a licensure by reciprocity. And I think a lot of states do that already. Through NAB, when they were using the reciprocity agreement, there were, I think, at least 22 states that were, had adopted that language, in their individual respective states. And I think it's a good idea for us to be a part of something like that as well, is to align ourselves with, substantially equivalent education, knowledge, and experience. And then, Jack, you have some other administrative things that I'd like you to address. But at this point, are there questions of me regarding some of the administrator issues?
Tana,
yes.
I have one on the reciprocity. Right now, it looks like all they have to do is hold a valid current license for 2 years that they've obtained by passing NAB and pass our examination. So I don't see any difference in that.
Okay. All right.
That's our current rule. So.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of things. Maybe we can thank you for the explanation. That was very helpful. I feel like this would be a little more organized if we could go through the bill in the order that the changes exist. For example, the very first substantive change is one that the director has suggested that I think the board needs because of some issues with either the fingerprint board or DPS. But I feel like it would be helpful if we could just go through these one at a time from the beginning, because there are some substantive issues there, and it would be great if we could kind of explore them one at a time. So if you would be willing to kind of start from page 4, where we have that first change, and let the director explain why we need this, and then we can move into the other changes, which I think are the workforce issues that you're requesting.
Okay. Well, that's a good idea.
Chair Kidder, members of the subcommittee, I don't have the draft right in front of me. Is the first substantive change the date of the fingerprinting?
It is.
Yes. So subcommittee members, this is the change where that started a year and a half ago as a suggestion to the legislature about how we can vet applicants, and we asked the board to give us a statutory authority to be able to do national FBI background checks for the NCIC. That was granted to us by the state of Arizona. However, DPS and the FBI have not yet given us access to those federal NCIC records. So that the date in there basically makes us look like we're not complying with the federal fingerprint background checks. So I'm trying to extend that date into next year so that we can comply with the statute. I do not yet know when the FBI is going to give us access to those background criminal information records yet.
Okay, thank you for doing that. I just wanted everyone here to understand why we were doing that.
Sure.
And to make it, and to, you know, I'll speak for myself. I don't have any issue with that change. I think it's important that the statute be updated if we're not able to comply with it. And so, Mr. Chairman, Member Archer, I'm fine with that change.
Mr. Chairman, quick question.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Dave Volpel, Arizona Healthcare. In regards to that change, instead of putting a date certain, why not put something in there as being able to conform to the, to say something like, as soon as they give us access, we'll be a part of it. That way it doesn't look like it's going from 2024 to 2026 because the board isn't wanting to be, you know, comply with it.
So, I love that. Yeah, will it be the FBI that will be granting us access?
Yes.
Whoever.
Yeah, they have very specific requirements for the NCIC data, staff training, you know, all those records are confidential and so forth. So, Dave, I did not ask Ledge Council. Those are my words from the original legislation. That's what I think they did. So I assume that we could change that or ask for a change of the sponsor if the subcommittee wants to do that.
So it's something changing the language is something that when granted access by the responsible entity or agency.
Yeah.
Decided to change that date. That was probably just the drafting lawyer trying to stick with the original format of the originally drafted statute. But if we give her a different direction, my guess is she'd be all right with it.
Yeah, I think that's good.
We'll have to run all this by her anyway. So now that it's dropped.
Yep. So noted. I don't think there's any opposition to that amongst the subcommittee, is there? Okay, hearing none.
Okay, then the next issue, Becky's in on page 5. The board may delegate to the executive director the authority to, and then several elements there.
Yeah, right. Is this dismissal, entered in consent agreement, et cetera?
Yes.
Yes, so the reason I put this in here is it's strictly administrative from my perspective, meaning this. In my mind, there are other health-related boards, i.e. Medical board, osteopathic board, dental board, that have this kind of language in their statutes already. And the reason they have that is because of the volume of cases that they're dealing with and the volume of those administrative decisions that they're dealing with. So if we have good policy and procedure in place where the board decides to delegate that to the staff, that can be done, and it cuts down on the case time, it cuts down on the time at the board meetings, so that we can really focus on what we need to talk about. So it is a iteration things, delegations to the executive director and his staff that other board, health-related boards have already that I thought very useful for this particular agency. So that's why I'm suggesting.
All right. Any questions or comments on this section?
Becky, I think you're muted.
Thank you. I sure was. So we've talked about this a few times the last couple of years. On its face, it's a great idea to give the director authority to dismiss complaints. In fact, we have moved from to a consent agenda approach for about a year now, which has really expedited the meetings and allowed us to focus in on the more severe cases. What's really keeping me from completely embracing this is understanding the criteria around which the director would dismiss complaints. Our legal counsel, I don't know if Mr. Monahan is on with us today, but he has said, I'm sorry, is Seamus on?
He was invited, but he's on personal leave. I don't know if he's
okay, that's fine. What he has said is we need to be really, really careful about how we phrase which complaints we would dismiss, because then we're really in a box. So, you know, if the director has a spidey sense about something we would normally dismiss on paper, he wouldn't have the authority to bring that to the board. And so, but in, I would say in almost every meeting, somebody has had to pull something from the dismissal list. I'm sorry, director, can you make sure you're muted? I think there's a little background noise. Thank you. So how can we solve this problem where he can have the authority, but there's still some criteria that the public and the board members understand around that decision making? And so what I thought of rather belatedly was not creating a matrix around criteria for dismissing, but criteria for not dismissing. So some of the things we've talked about in the past is, you know, don't dismiss if, you know, a manager or administrator has multiple complaints before the board on the exact same agenda. Like, that's never made sense to any of us. You can still put it on a consent agenda if somebody has a question. You want to just out of hand dismiss it. Don't dismiss repeat violations that are relative to residents' rights or resident safety. You know, just two or three categories of things where, or don't dismiss any complaint that involves an injury, death, abuse, or sexual assault of a resident. Because occasionally you'll see something on there and you're like, okay, this resident was assaulted. Why are we dismissing this case? And then once you hear it, you understand why. However, when the public sees that we're dismissing cases that involve sexual assault, I think we have a responsibility to air a little bit in a meeting why that case is being dismissed. And so what I would ask is that this not move forward unless we have an amendment that says something like, the board may delegate to the executive director the authority to, with everything you already have there, director, but with the requirement that the board have a public meeting around the about which complaints that would normally meet the director's discretion around dismissal would never be dismissed. So that the public knows they're always going to see those cases. And if we're not going to adopt a never dismiss matrix, at least have a public meeting, you know, at a full board meeting where the advocates could come in and talk a little bit about some suggestions around how those dismissals are administrated. So I understand the need for this authority. I don't oppose it on its face. I just think that the public and, quite frankly, the board deserves to know what decision-making is going into those dismissals. Thank you for hearing me out.
So, Becky, if I heard you right, if I didn't, I just want to make sure I do. So you'd say maybe the language the board staff may be allowed to dismiss, you know, and, you know, so that they have the authority, but they want to, before they dismiss some of these cases, at least get it on the consent agenda so that if there are questions or if they need to be pulled and reviewed, we have that opportunity at that time.
I think the staff is already putting, just cases they would normally just administratively dismiss on the public consent agenda. The way I read this authority is they could administratively dismiss complaints without it ever showing up on the agenda. Isn't that right, Jack?
That is correct. This is
right.
And that is correct. The staff could dismiss it if it meets certain criteria. The idea behind the legislation is to give the board the authority to delegate. And in the way I've seen it done, in other boards is they, when they decide to do, they don't have to. You may have the statutory authority to delegate, but the board may decide that they don't want to delegate certain things. That's when our policy procedure comes in. What looks like, smells like, tastes like a dismissal is a dismissal. And that is the policy that we staff would bring to the board, and they would sign off on it or they wouldn't sign off on it. And then that would establish the how those cases proceed through the review process at the staff level.
Okay, thank you. And that's what I want to clarify here, that prior to being granted that authority, that there is a discussion around the policy that would drive those dismissals, and that there would be a public discussion about it at a full board meeting before there was a vote on it. Because this is kind of high-stakes stuff, you know what I mean? There's occasionally something sitting, and all the work that this is the hardest working board. They have so much work, very few resources, a really small staff. I totally, in theory, support what we're doing here. I just want to make sure there's lots of transparency and structure and understanding about how we're doing it, so that we don't miss something important and the public doesn't think we're just trying to dump work. So if I'd be happy to draft something, because it's hard to talk draft. I'm not good at that. But I'd be happy to draft something and have it shared, you know, around. It would just be two lines.
So you're talking about amending this language?
Yes.
Okay. That would be a recommendation for the subcommittee to the board. Ken, members of the subcommittee.
Okay, so yeah. All right. So let's make this is
page 5.
Yeah,
line 40R. It would be two bullet points that I'll draft. One, that the board has to have a full public meeting and hear from the public on the policy that will drive the dismissal work, and then the board has to adopt the policy. So the board has to adopt the policy the staff will use going forward.
All right.
And just to have that in statute, so there's no misunderstanding that you can't just start dismissing complaints. There has to be a board policy on it.
All right. Well, thank you for your comments on that, Becky, and willingness to help with the amendment. So then I forward this recommendation, page 5, line 40R, that recommendations for amendment to be brought before the board.
In a full public hearing where the public could comment.
Okay. Yes, before the full board with at a full public hearing and public comment.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you.
Chairman Kidder, I unfortunately need to excuse myself. The committee meeting is coming back to order, okay?
Okay. All right.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Bye.
All right. Bye. Thanks, Jack. Okay.
I think those were Jack's two big items anyway. So good timing.
All right. So then if we move on to the top of page 7, here's the change for administrative criteria: has obtained an associate degree in nursing or related health profession, or is a licensed as a health professional in an inpatient healthcare institution. Now, I gave one example of how this would work with my director of nursing. I also had a rehab director who was a physical therapy assistant and worked with me for a number of years and was extremely competent, understood the operations of the facility, the whole bigger picture. But I really want to see him become an administrator at some point in his life. He's moved on out of state, but you know, he has those aspirations, and after 30 years in this business, he's competent enough to be able to do it. So in his case, he would have to go through an administrator and training program in order to be able to set for the test. This language here would enable him to not have to complete the AIT, because I don't think he needs it at this point. That is my purpose for this language.
Hey, Ken, is this specific for you and your staff, or is this going to be, if it's going to be statewide and include everybody, how do we know what their background is and what their ability to do the job?
Well, I think they're going to have to provide a do, I don't know if we have it in rule, but they have to provide their qualifications, a CV or, you know, a resume. We need to see that. And then do we have reference checks set up? You know, it's, and I think when we say, you know, a health professional, so it could be a therapist, it could be a nurse, could be a nurse practitioner, you know, any of these other professions where there is, you know, at least an associate's degree required.
Yeah, but I think you know as well as I do that the AIT program really prepares the people for becoming, you know, an administrator in a long-term care setting. Because, you know, a lot of people, they may come in with the education, but they don't have any of the experience.
Well,
in all the different departments and whatnot.
Yeah, no, yeah. I do understand that, but at this point, the way our current rules are is that if somebody has a master's degree in a health-related profession, they don't need to have an administrator in training program. So that's already, you know, in our rules, and does it make it any different that a master's degree person that maybe doesn't even have experience can bypass the AIT?
I have a question. Can you relate what we are currently doing to what other states do and how they're receiving reciprocity clients, potential administrators and or somebody who's new, you know, do they have similar criteria that we do, or is our criteria higher than the rest of the country?
Our criteria is higher than a number of states. I can't give you a number because I don't know. But I do know that when NAB was using the reciprocity agreement, there were, I think, Al, if you remember, it was around 22 states were part of that. You know, some states don't require a college degree at all.
Okay, please, Alan, go ahead.
I don't know, you know, if NAB requires anything on their end, you know, to test for the NAB. I think it's up to the states. If they allow it and they approve the application, they can test. But whether that person would qualify to go to another state, you know, if they decided to or not, I don't know. But that would be up to the other state if they accepted them or not. So Ken, under our current rule, you know, where you hold a minimum of a associate's degree in nursing or accredited college or university, and they're currently licensed as a registered nurse, they work 5 to 7 years. So it's really the AIT on the program that you want to get rid of.
Yes.
We can just do that in rule. Just exit.
Okay.
I'm really sorry, Alan, what are you suggesting?
Really don't need to add that statute. We already have the authority to determine the education and training based on our current statute.
Yeah, that was actually one of my questions. Like, is this something that Jeff wants to jump in here?
Thank you, Subcommittee and Chairman Kidder. As a licensed nursing home administrator since 1987, I have to speak to the impact of the AIT program. And I, Ken, like you, I have worked with directors of nursing and nurses and other folks in my career that would make fantastic administrators, but because they have maybe not done an AIT that includes rotations through, say, dining services, laundry, housekeeping, they are missing out on a significant chunk, because who gets called in on Saturday morning at 6 o'clock in the morning when dining is down an employee or the washing machine needs to be readjusted on Sunday morning? There's just so much education outside of their purviews that even for a master's prepared, I have put, Alan was the executive director way back when I put a candidate through with his master's, but we did an abbreviated AIT for him even because his master's didn't cover everything. So I am just very if we can talk then about maintaining an AIT, but if they have, they're an RN, they don't have to do their nursing section of the AIT program. That's just mine as a provider. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. That's very important. I agree with you. I think AIT is very good. So that maybe the wording needs to, or maybe we need to make a recommendation to work with that wording. Or Al, if you think it's better to would that be something that could just be pulled and then put through rule? Because if we do get new statutes, we're going to have to open a rule packet. You know, and is that something that could be added? Okay.
And what I see and what we've done in the past is the wording we have currently in the administrator licensing, we could generate rules and we can determine the education and training in any category that we want.
So it sounds like what Jeff was talking about is maybe to create some sort of hybrid training where...
Actually, we're the ones that determine the AIT, you know, as a board. Typically, we outline it in Rule R433-301 as to what an AIT has to go through and what a preceptor or, you know, the preceptor has to do as far as the trainer. So, and I think most of the states require about 1,000 hours. But
I think one of the most accepted programs is through the American College of Healthcare Administrators, which is 1,000.
Yeah. Now, it's Jeff Barrett again with the Arizona Healthcare Association. Some also understand that some corporations that run AIT programs through their corporate bodies also have extended those hours as well, depending on their needs. But that's outside of board purview.
Correct.
Yeah. So a few comments on this section. Certainly... If there need to be changes here, it goes through, you know, board rule, board statute, you know, one or the other, all of the above. I would suggest rule if we already have the authority to do it there, unless there's deep divisions about how to do it, which unfortunately gets me to my next point. You know, I hear what you're saying, Ken. I know the challenges around workforce are immense, but I think the biggest challenge around workforce is quality. And so, you know, I'm a little concerned to see what appears to be diluting the requirements to be a SNF administrator brought by the board rather than through industry. But I do think it's a relevant conversation for us to have. But I will say there was a comment by the board through the director during NCIA's sunset sunrise process last year to dilute the requirements for becoming an administrator. And I talked about that to the committee of reference as a member of the public, not on behalf of the board. The director was there to make his case. You know, and the legislature was nervous about diluting the requirements. But I do think there's more than one way to skin a cat. You know, if there's a way to say, well, if you have a master's and all this experience and you already have the hours, you know, that might be one pathway. If you have no hours and no experience and you only have an AA degree, no, I don't want you to automatically become an administrator for a skilled nursing facility. So I think there might be some different scenarios that maybe, maybe the industry could put together a little committee. Maybe everybody could send in some recommendations about the rule and we could have a committee around the rule. But I would certainly say that, there is a little bit of concern about going this far, this fast, and I would prefer to try to do it by rule rather than by statute. That would create its own process where we could focus on this one issue, and that would make me more comfortable. Otherwise, I oppose it as it is currently written. So I don't know if anyone else wants to weigh in on that idea of trying to do the work through rulemaking. or at least coming to some consensus as a group outside of this, the study committee, because I can't sign off on this language today.
So if we were able to come through some sort of consensus to changing statute, would you be okay with not going through the whole rule process so we can get movement here?
You would still have to go through rulemaking. If you're changing a statute that exists in a rule that you have authority to oversee, which is where our licensure certification requirements are, you would still have to do rulemaking.
Okay.
Sorry. I mean, someone from the industry, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm under the impression you still have to do rulemaking.
No, that's You're probably right. My misunderstanding. I'm just saying instead of opening a whole separate process, is there a way that we can incorporate this and get through the language of it for right now?
No, not for me. I mean, we're going to – the idea of changing requirements over time for all of the workforce is an idea that has merit, right? Increasing, decreasing. Right now we're talking about bolstering memory care preparation for administrators and caregivers. But I think anything that involves a broad sweep of saying everybody in this profession only has to have an AA degree. You've already heard two well-respected people in industry speak to the importance of AIT. I just think this is premature. So we can either try to do it through a working group and then decide if it's statute and or rule or just rule. But I think this deserves a separate conversation if we want this bill to move without a lot of controversy so that the things that need to be done that we do have consensus on can move. This is going to have to come out of the bill. That's my opinion.
So what we need to bolster here to continue the discussion is that if the AIT is removed, that individual is going to have to demonstrate sufficient knowledge and experience of all the other disciplines that are required in a skilled nursing setting. So maybe there's some language that could be put in there. And I agree with you that we want to make sure that they understand all aspects. From as far as an AA degree, that would not apply at all to initial licensure. Is going to have to continue to be a bachelor's degree plus 1,000-hour AIT. So that's somebody like me that came in with no experience, I think, is absolutely the best way to do it.
And so I just lost my train of thought. I beg your pardon.
Susan, while you're getting it back, I don't think that's what this bill says, Ken. I don't think it says if you have a ton of experience, then you can go this alternative route. I just think it says you can go this alternative route.
I hear you with what you're saying, but I think also what you're saying is that we need to ensure that if they're going to be able to bypass the AIT, that they can demonstrate sufficient knowledge and experience. And that's either if it's going to go through statute, we're going to need to add language to make sure that we wrap around all the disciplines of the skilled nursing world. If it goes through rule, we're going to have to address it the same way.
So my question I remembered now is there more robust testing? Is there maybe a checkoff system that's a speedway through the AIT portion? If somebody has this kind of clinical experience that you're discussing, has been boots on the ground, can a proctor or preceptor take them through a matrix of checklist prior to them taking a test?
Well,
that opens up a whole different avenue, because we have one approved AIT program, and they run it very, very well. But you can't open it up. You shouldn't open it up to just anyone being a preceptor. They have to have the qualifications and the experience and be in the industry at the time that they do it. So,
but that person by definition could still do an abbreviated skills check like we do in AL. I mean, we do orientation and skills checks and.
With all due respect to that point,
yeah.
My dear friend, Susan Archer, AL is not skilled nursing. I mean.
I just I'm just asking, is there a hybrid that would meet everybody's needs and qualifications and satisfy both sides of this issue? That's all.
Chairman Kidder, this is Jeff Barrett again with the Arizona Healthcare Association. Speaking from past past experience, when we start getting into one from column A, two from column B, and one from column C, we lose the ability to have subjectivity, objectivity when we're looking at folks. And I've actually worked in a program like that, similar to what Susan has just been, Member Archer's just been saying, is that you need to find a preceptor that is not the AIT's preceptor to carry out that competency check. And that just becomes another time burden for the process, in my opinion.
Well, in our AITs, we had our preceptor plus then a program evaluator who is an independent third party who reviewed that. I agree with that, Jeff. I think that's a great idea. I mean, it has to be an uninterested third party.
But to clarify, I thought I heard Jeff say that just add more layers.
It does.
He's not suggesting you doing it. He's arguing why we shouldn't be doing it. And so I'm going to continue to say this is not ready for prime time. And it is going to be a point of contention at the legislature. Yeah, I already know that.
What I hear is we do not have consensus on this one. So either we back up, we have another committee meeting to discuss any proposed language changes to see if we want to run this through through this legislation, or if we want to pull it and just pull it back to rule and give us more time to work through it.
As this meeting is on record, I do want to go back and say that is correct, Member Hill. Thank you.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you. All right. So with this section, I will report to the board that there is no consensus on this and that board reevaluate if we need to either pull it from the legislation and bring it back around through rule. Then it also gives us time and our stakeholders time that, we can sit down and discuss, is there a way that we can open us up to qualified people without it having the perception of diluting the requirements for licensure? Does that sound okay?
Or actually diluting the requirements for licensure.
Well, it's not.
I think there could be comparable pathways, but I don't. Yeah. So we can talk about that at the stakeholder meeting.
Okay. All right. Next comes up to page 8. Let's see. Reciprocity just kind of cleans up some language there. Any issues with that proposed change? And this is line 15 on page 8, reciprocity present administrators.
I wanted to have a discussion about it. I don't know that I'm opposed. I feel nervous about the revocation language. Several years ago for another industry, I actually helped lead the effort for better reciprocity to make it easier for professionals from other states to work here in a variety of industries, actually done it a few times. But license, revocation was usually where we drew the line. We heard just this week at our NCIA board meeting from an Arizona administrator manager whose license was revoked a year ago, and she was nowhere ready to come back. And so I believe the process is, Jack's not here, but Ken, I know you and Susan can fill in here. That any applicant that has discipline on the record generally comes before the board anyway before we give them a license. I don't, if that would still happen here, I'm fine with the discipline piece because, we send managers to professional development and we call that discipline, right? So, I'm okay with that language generally, but I'm very uncomfortable with the revocation language, and I'm wondering what our friends who've joined this meeting think.
Coalition Revocation Discipline.
Alan, could you say that again, please?
I said FISN Revocation Discipline.
Yeah, it is. Becky, what do you want to see? Are you saying that,
I don't want people hopping to Arizona because they've had their license revoked for a really good reason, and now we're going to give them a license. If it was an administrative snafu, like they forgot to pay their fee or they didn't pass, even not passing the test makes me nervous, but that's probably my own thing. What if there was a revocation, just for negligence? I don't want to come one, come all strategy for licensing people. That's why we have the standards that we have, and revocation feels like a line I don't want to cross.
Well, I guess, am I reading it wrong? To me, it says the applicant has not been disciplined or had an equivalent license revoked within a year before applying for a license pursuant to this article. So we're saying if they have had discipline or revocation within a year, they can't apply. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, you're reading it right.
Okay, so that they've had disciplinary action or a revocation for a similar license within the last year, we're not going to take their application.
Even if they did apply, they wouldn't meet the administrative completeness because they don't meet that statute.
So if someone's had their license revoked for a really good reason and it's been 1 year and 4 days, then they could apply. I would just like us to take revocation more seriously. We take it very seriously with the managers and administrators we revoke. Why wouldn't we provide some weight to those who are coming in from out of state and leaving somewhere to try to get a license elsewhere where there might be weaker standards?
But they would still go through the same process when they're answering the questionnaire to say, have you had something revoked? And then they would come mm-hmm. before us before they were ever granted their license. That would
if we're already doing process. That, why do we have this in the bill? Just curious. Just process question. If Jack's already bringing these people before us, if staff is already processing them and making a determination that they want us to, that we have to look at them because they've applied and we don't have a reason not to.
Is there a compelling reason not to leave it in? To me, this would solidify that this is our standard and it is in statute. And per our policies, if they answer in the affirmative that they've had one of these situations, I'm going to want to talk to them. I'm not going to just grant them a license. They're going to have to come before us and explain that even at 1 year and 4 days, what have they done to change themselves that this is not kind of conduct isn't going to happen again. So does this just give us a little bit more strength in the statute to be able to administer what we're already doing?
Is Danita on to clarify what we do when we have an application for an out-of-state, someone who's come here from out-of-state? Do we check to see if we ask them to disclose licensure issues, but they don't always disclose. For example, a couple months ago, we had a young lady we didn't realize she'd been licensed. She was licensed in another state prior. She disclosed it in her opening comments. We didn't have it in our record. Are we looking for that?
The reciprocity statute here only applies to administrators, not managers.
Okay, I would say go ahead and skip this for now and go ahead and leave it in. I'm going to ask the staff some more questions, but I absolutely will flag, If the process we have now is stronger than this, then I will not want to see this in the bill.
Yeah, no, I don't want it to be any less strong than what we have at this point. Absolutely not.
Okay. All right. So it's the placeholder and,
okay.
We can come back to it.
All right.
Thanks, Ellen, for your help.
Okay, so we have consensus on that. And then next is temporary licenses and certificates renewal. So this one specifically gets rid of the element of temporary license or certificate is automatically revoked if the license or certificate holder fails either the state or national exams during the term of the license or certificate. And then it proposes that, that temporary license would be valid for 150 days. And then, let's see, temporary license or certificate may be renewed one time for an additional 60 days. And I think the rationale here is that, you know, our applicants are within a substantive time period. Some have to take tests multiple times before they pass. Does it, just by failing an exam one time, does that really require an automatic revocation of the temporary license? Because they're still within their substantive time period to prove to us that they are competent to be able to become an administrator, and if they can do it within that time period, then, you know, do we need to revoke the temporary, or just let them keep that temporary? And then at the end of the 5 months, if they haven't gotten their license, they're out. You know, the organization they're working for is not going to be able to use them.
They wouldn't even have to test, Ken.
What's that?
I said an applicant on a temporary wouldn't even have to test. They could just let it go. They could never test at all.
I would.
So the purpose of a temporary license, Jeff or Karen or Dave, whoever's on from industry, is, and obviously Ken, but is to fill an otherwise unfillable job. Is that the purpose of a temporary license? What are you using the temporary licenses for?
At the facility level, DHS wants a license in the facility all the time, but not to exceed 30 days without a license. So the temporary would be the temporary fill.
Okay. You know, the 150 days feels sufficient for me. You know, I guess I understand saying, okay, they failed at once. Can we still give them the 150 days to figure it out? But I don't understand why we're giving them grace after the 150 days or why we would extend their license for another 60 days. You know, we already see a lot of people have trouble with these tests, which I think is a red flag on some of these training programs, quite frankly. But I don't want the temporary license becoming the de facto fallback for folks who can't pass the test. We sometimes see this in education where people who can't qualify get an emergency license, not because the school needs teachers on an emergency basis, but because they can't pass the educator test. So unless you're telling me there's, again, I feel like this is something that should come from industry with some data around their workforce, but I don't see a reason for fee, for sure. And I don't understand the utility of ignoring failure after having been had a temporary license. Letting people fail a test into perpetuity does not create confidence in what we're doing.
David or Jeff, as ACA leadership and dealing with administrators, what do you see of the value of this element?
So, Chairman Kidder, one of the things that we do see is people run up on, especially when testing timeframes start to lag, which right now they're not, but as of a year, year and a half ago, they were lagging. And so getting through that 150 days was pretty short timeframe. And so we had asked, we've had members ask that, is there any way to extend the license? So the temporary license so that they could make sure they get within the testing requirements. Now that has been reduced greatly, that timeframe, However, it could be expanded once again. That's the first thing. The second thing is, some people take these tests two or three times, and because they're bad test takers and they struggle with taking the test and they need one more go around at it. And you got to cut it off somewhere. I get that. But cutting them off at one or two or that 150 days, sometimes they just need that extra 60 days to just take that third test and to get it done. And so we've had a huge amount of people, but there have been over the last 18 months or so, a set of people that are just, they're like, we need to take it one more time and now we can't do it because it's expired at 150 days. Gives you a little more latitude. The board retains control of that. You don't have to grant the extra temporary license. I mean, you can look at somebody and if they took it six times, as you know, as Member Hill was referencing, if they took it six times, all right, maybe enough's enough. Go work someplace else. So, but that's under the board's purview.
So to clarify, is one of the issues just the timing of when tests are available and perhaps the person actually getting able to schedule on time for more than one test? Is that why the extension might be needed?
Member Archer, that's what we were seeing, especially coming out of COVID, through COVID, coming out of COVID, up until about a year and a half ago, the testing resources in Arizona were not up to snuff. We were even begging CMS to come in and allowing us to have another testing resource because there's only one that's allowed through contract in the state. So it's been cleaned up since then. It's been, the time frame's been shortened, but that's not to say it won't happen again. So this just gives the board the latitude to add on to those 60 days if they see fit.
Okay. Hey, David, on the temporary, what they're striking is that if they fail, it's automatically revoked. So if they did go ahead and test it, they would have a, you know, their temporary would be revoked. If they're striking that and just leaving the 150 days, then the person could test at least until their administrative time frame expires on their original application, which is about 135 days. So,
so that cap, Alan, would remain in this language?
Yeah, the other thing that comes to mind, too, is automatically revoke. I don't know if there was a due process issue on the revocation or not. That was brought up. I think Jack told me the other day about that. That Seamus had some question about, you know, can you automatically revoke a certificate because they failed an exam without due process? I don't know.
Chairman Kidder, this is right. Jeff Barrett with the Arizona Healthcare Association. Just for point of clarification, we're speaking of the state exams for skilled nursing administrators and assisted living managers, not the NAB.
It would be both. If they fail either of them.
Thank you.
And then, Becky, you had your hand up too.
No, I was just, you know, doing this.
Okay, Susan.
Yeah.
Okay, my hand is up. Yes. And if I read this correctly, it's for temporary license or certificate, meaning for a manager. So the language would be the same for both. Is that correct? With our lowly certificate of a manager.
It's for both.
Thank you.
All right. Do we have consensus to support this at this time?
I don't completely understand what the backstop is. That's what I was asked. Maybe I do. So, Alan, what is the backstop for testing into perpetuity? It's the 135 days, or it would now be 150 plus 60. What would it be?
On the temp, well, they're, because they have to apply both for their original and the temporary at the same time, and they would be issued the temporary ahead of the permanent one only after they pass the examination. So they okay. could wait 2 or 3 months to take the examination and still be issued a temporary, work on a temporary. and then take the examination and pass it, and then they wouldn't have to get their permit. They put off getting their paying for their permanent for until the temporary expired, or they could get the permanent, and it would kind of be dual. But as far as the temporary, 150 days, it runs pretty much concurrent with their main application, which is 135 days.
But this would take it to 200 and some.
We've had candidates also that all they needed was a temporary, and they never tested at all. And once the 150 days was up, their application was gone and their temp was gone too.
Okay, it feels like the time for needing this language has passed, but it's fine. I'll figure out what the backstop is with staff, and if it's anything concerning, Dave, I'll call you guys. For now, we'll just stay good.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Becky. All right, let's see here. Next. Just on page 10, line 4, they just changed it. It said a civil monetary penalty not to exceed $500, and it was just changed to more than $500. So that's just a semantics change.
It's also inconsistent with another one at the end of the rule.
Okay.
Statute. Let's see, the last page, which says $1,000. So.
Okay, then the next is down to line 16 on page 10. Board may issue a non-disciplinary order to a licensee or certificate holder who fails to complete continuing education requirements. A disciplinary or non-disciplinary order of the board may include a requirement to reimburse the board's investigative costs. And essentially, we already have that. I don't understand this element. Alan, do you have thoughts on this?
Which one are you on?
Page 10, starting on line 16. I mean, in board meetings, we've taken disciplinary action on those that have failed to comply with their consent agreements.
Right.
Oh. So
I think this just puts it into statute.
Yeah, this is for non-disciplinary.
This is for non-disciplinary, yeah.
License or certificate holder fails to complete the continuing education requirements. In other words, if they didn't meet their requirements, we could issue a non-disciplinary order. But
they would still have to reimburse for fees.
Also include reimbursement costs for the disciplinary non-disciplinary order for continuing.
Yeah, when they don't comply, we now have to do everything twice. I think it makes sense that if you're not going to do what you're asked to do the first time and we have to redo the paperwork and call you and potentially have you come back before the board, they should reimburse us for our costs. Mm-hmm. All right. I think the rest is conforming change. Just because Ledge Council doesn't say biennially anymore, they say every 2 years. Plain language, how about that?
Okay, so then we come down to page 12. Okay, Al, if you can weigh in on this one, it looks like it's this relate back to the board having greater authority to adjudicate, to negotiate consent agreements prior to a board meeting, much like the Board of Nursing does, that if somebody's willing to agree to a consent agreement, then the board staff can negotiate that consent agreement and get it signed. And this would then, it looks like it also gives power If the licensee or certificate holder refuses the invitation for a formal interview or accepts and results indicate that grounds may exist for revocation or suspension, then the board can issue a complaint and order that hearing will be held. So it would go to formal, this would give them the authority to move it to formal hearing?
Move it formal hearing from a formal interview, yeah.
Okay.
My one question on this, Mr. Chairman, was again around the dismissal and whether or not this would follow the prior process that we're setting up under the other section. When it says the complaint would be dismissed if it's found to be without merit, merit sounds like a little bit of a subjective judgment call. I'd be more comfortable if it said insufficient evidence or something like that, or we connected it back to the process we're creating in the other dismissal statute. So I would like to ask, we could ask Ledge Council how to tie the two together, if that makes sense. To make sure the dismissal criteria is the same. Thank you.
All right, great idea. Thank you. Okay. All right, and through the rest of the body, Dave, from ACCA, you had made a comment towards the end of that on page 14, starting lines 4 and 5. You want to weigh in on that for us?
Yeah, Chairman Kidder, thank you. The civil penalties look exorbitantly high and out of realm of, I mean, if you look at what happened with House Bill 2764 last year, where fines and penalties were increased for a facility or a community from $500 to $1,000 per occurrence per resident harmed, this goes all the way from $1,000 to $10,000 per violation. That's exorbitant. That could bankrupt somebody. I mean, we're talking individuals here, not facilities, I'm assuming. And that seems awfully high. I would think it could be put back more in order of what's further back in the bill, or you could say something of $500 with, I don't know, not more than whatever the case might be. I don't know. There could be some wording changes in there regarding the violation or even the severity of the violation. You could have things in there. I don't know. I'm just talking off the top of my head here, but $1,000 to $10,000 seems highly exorbitant.
Hey, David, that was the inconsistency that I saw in this. We have 500.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
And then 1,000 for the same thing. It's civil penalty. So for the violation. And so there's an inconsistency in this part.
And is this in addition to reimbursement of investigative costs?
This is separate.
So it could be in addition to and applies to license and managers certificates?
It would be to both. And could the board impose a civil money penalty? Probably not on a consent agreement. They could, but typically if it's an order, you know, through a formal hearing, they would, if there's going to be a penalty, it would be a civil money penalty, and reimbursement costs would be off the table. Only on consent would reimbursement costs.
Okay.
So, okay, to dovetail off both you, Al, and David, if we go back to page 9, line 10, 36-446.07, under disciplinary actions, where the language there and on page 10, line 3, it says board may issue a civil monetary penalty in the amount of not more than $500. So I think I agree that we need to do some. What are we trying to accomplish with that element? Because you're right, the amount is not consistent with what we already have in statute.
Right.
All right. So we don't have consensus. So this one's going back to a recommendation to the board to find out what is it that we want to accomplish with this. And it appears to conflict with, where am I?
Yeah, your with, page 10 reference. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm fine taking it out pending the director's explanation for why this was added. I would give him some deference to try to explain it, but honestly, if most managers did something where we would feel it important to fine them $10,000, we would likely just revoke their
right.
certificate or their license.
That's totally correct. Yeah.
Yeah. But I would want to hear what Jack had to say, but I can say, I think for now, that's probably not something that anyone here is willing to fight for.
And it's really the amount, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
We want to have civil penalty authority, but we have the $500 to your point, Dave. These are individuals, not facilities. And I think we need to take that into account.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So this is going back to board for clarification and fix whatever we need to get the amounts consistent. All right. Then I see down on under fees, there is a fee proposed addition for a duplicate license as a nursing care institution administrator. And am I correct, Ella, that currently there is no fee for a duplicate license?
Right.
Okay. Any concern about that, or do we have consensus?
There's nothing in statute.
Okay.
So wouldn't it be consistent to have a fee for a duplicate administrator license if there is one for a manager's duplicate?
They have one for managers in the statute.
Would it not be consistent to have one for administrators?
Yeah, agreed.
All right, so that...
Chairman Kidder, it's Jeff Barrett with the Arizona Healthcare Association. Again, as a licensed nursing home administrator, so the board would, if I requested one, because say I lost my license or got awful, something got awful happened to the piece of paper on my wall, it would be charged. I would pay a prorated rate based on the number of months left on my license to have it redone.
I can't answer that for sure, but my understanding and the way this reads, it would be for a second license for, you know, that 90-day period that we have in rule right now. So if you had to, Jeff, if you had to take over a second building just down the street for the next 3 months, you could get a duplicate license and you wouldn't be charged for that duplicate. Okay. And if we need more cleaner language to say this is not for a replacement license, but for a duplicate for a second.
Additional,
an additional.
Member Hill, because it's kind of confusing that it goes 14 is at line 25 and then it's B at line 26. There doesn't seem to be an A.
The A is up on line 7.
Okay. Oh, there it is. So because when you read this, it looks like 14 and B go together. And that's where I question
the rated
monthly basis.
Hey, Ken, I don't know, you know, looking at it, if you look at number 9, line 18, it already lists a duplicate license. Why do we need 14? Why do we need the new language if it's already included in 9? And this is for nursing care administrators.
Under A, the board rules shall establish non-refundable fees and penalties for the following for nursing care institution administrators. One is a duplicate license. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Maybe what they need is to just add to line 9 the nursing care administrator duplicate. Cause under temporary. Yeah. Cause it says a license as an administrator, a temporary as an administrator, and maybe after duplicate, they just need to add the phrase nursing care administrator.
No.
It looked like somebody was trying to true up the, you know, the conforming style, and it ended up as an extra line rather than a fix. I see that as a technical fix, but we can have Ledge Council move it up to line 9. Thanks.
There's no reason to have nursing care administrators, institution administrators, because 8 covers it.
9 covers it, right?
Yeah, A and 9.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So just
yeah, we don't need 14 either way.
Okay. Okay. Any other thoughts, comments? I want to thank you each of you very much for being a part of this important meeting today and the time that you've taken to give your comments and thoughts. I think there's some great information here that will help clean this up. You know, we want it to be successful, to be able to keep modern and be able to have the proper authority to do what we're doing and to protect our vulnerable individuals and the ability and the power to be able to discipline those who don't want to do it right. So again, thank you. And, we need further discussions. I think this one was very helpful. And I think this will give us opportunity to get through Ledge Council, get it cleaned up even further before it starts getting into committee. So unless there's anything else, I will go ahead and adjourn the meeting, and thank you again, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.